Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Today we welcome back Larry Tai for his fourth time on Spirit in Action. Larry Tai captures history and writes books about transformation, like the progress brought about by the black musicians who so thoroughly captured hearts in the USA across racial boundaries. Larry's latest book is The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America, a combination of legends, deep examination, and inspirational storytelling. This is the ninth book by Larry, all of which open hearts and minds with real-life stories. We have another 4 minutes of this interview, bits about Duke Ellington's middle name, about Kansas City, and about Fats Waller in the full uncut version on northernspiritradio.org. Thanks to Andrew Jansen for production assistance on today's program. Right now, Larry Tai joins us via Zoom. Larry, it's great to have you back now after, I think, 4 years for Spirit in Action.
Mark, it is wonderful to be back with you.
Last time when we were together, I think it was 2020, we were talking about the infamous Joe McCarthy. How much better do you feel not researching Joe McCarthy for years and years? I think 3 years you spent on that.
Yes. So I feel infinitely better. The idea of being able to spend 3 years with these toe-tappingly fun musicians is the perfect antidote to spending three with Joe McCarthy.
He makes me feel bad about Wisconsin, Joe McCarthy did. But, you know, I think the John Birch Society started here. So did the good Republican Party. You know, Wisconsin's had a lot of good and bad and really a mixture.
I've never seen a state with as polar opposites. Wisconsin, as you know much better than me, has had an extraordinary polar set of people who have served in Congress representing the state. The idea that Joe McCarthy's seat was taken, I think, by Bill Proxmire, who I think of as one of the most constructive senators in recent American history, is just a sign of the way your state bounces here and there. But in the end, America saw Joe McCarthy for what he was, and like most demagogues, in the end, he saw his natural downfall.
We can always hope it goes that way. Sometimes we fear that it'll go on and on and on. But now we're talking about the Jazzmen, how Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie transformed America. My big question is, am I saying it wrong when I say Louis Armstrong?
You're saying it right, depending on who was deciding what nickname to stick him with. His mother preferred Louis and insisted that was the only right name. A couple of his wives used Louis, and Louis Armstrong said, as long as you call me in time for dinner, I don't care what you call me.
Well, and he also got called Satchmo, which Satchel Mouth. I mean, that is such a bizarre name, and he evidently wore it with pride, too.
He did, and Satchel Mouth came from the fact that when he was a youngster growing up in New Orleans, in order to put food on the table for his mother and his sister, and he played a major role in doing that, he would go perform whatever shows he could in the streets of the city. That could sometimes mean blowing a horn. It could mean dancing. And in order to safeguard the money that he was raising, he would stick the pennies and nickels into his enormous mouth. And in addition to his mouth eventually proving to be the perfect instrument to play the trumpet and to sing with, it also was the perfect satchel for his money. Satchel Mouth was something that he was dubbed by friends on the street. One day, a British music critic shortened it to Satchmo, and that stuck, and he loved it.
It's so amusing. There's a lot of amusing stories about these three foundational people for jazz in the United States. And there's some that are fairly distressing. When I finished reading The Jazzmen, I did not have a heavy heart. I was uplifted. But some of the steps along the way had me very distressed. The drug, the gambling, infidelities, all of these things that the biggest people of the day had. I don't know if their backgrounds in it got more or less exposed than their white counterparts. Do you have a sense of that? Did they get treated better or worse by the press because they were black?
They got generally, if there was a differentiation because of their race in terms of how they were treated by the music press and the general press, it was generally to their detriment. They were called all kinds of slur words by the press in this country and overseas. On the other hand, the press also, over time, recognized their genius and helped build them up. And I'm not sure that they ever benefited from excessively ebullient coverage, but at least it became fairer as time went on. And I think that the press was a reflection of the society, and the society was one that, even as it was dazzled by their music, it still had a difficult time in that Jim Crow era of segregation and racism, of giving them the treatment that geniuses like those deserved.
You know, I'm tempted to start different ways on all three of these men, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Louis Armstrong. But I think the one I really need to start with is Larry Tye, because I don't know if I think of you as a person just vitally connected with history in this country, or whether there's some deep, some people would call it political, I might call it social awareness, motivation. That, why do you pick out the Jazzmen? Is it because you like jazz, or is it because you like blacks? Is it because you like history? Is it you want America to be a better place? What gets Larry Tye to cover the Jazzmen?
There's a simple reason for why I wrote this book. I wrote an earlier book on the black men who worked on the railroads called Pullman Porters. And from the end of the Civil War through the 1960s, arguably the best job a black man could get in America, in terms of everything from the money that they were earning to the respect that they were accorded to their chance to see the country, was to be a Pullman porter. And when I wrote about the Pullman porters, when I started interviewing them, there were 40 of them alive. When I finished my book a little over a year later, there were 20 of them alive, and today there are zero alive. But I promised the Pullman porters that someday I would write another book about their three favorite passengers, who were three guys named Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie. And the reason I tell you that story is because I think the reason the Jazzmen were the porters' favorite passengers says a lot about not just all of those people, but about America at the time. In the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, when these Jazzmen would travel south, if they knocked on the wrong door of a restaurant or tried to get a room in the wrong hotel, they could be berated, they could be beaten, and they could end up at the end of a hangman's noose. And they knew that the only safe way to travel south, when they could afford to do it this way, was to rent a private Pullman sleeping car. And if they were doing a concert, let's say in Atlanta, at the end of their concert, late into the evening, they knew that when they went back to their car, which was off on a sidetrack, that they would get a terrific meal served by the dining car waiters. They would get an amazing bed made by the Pullman porters, and they would get safety. They knew that that was the only way to be safe. And in return, what they did for the porters, and this is one reason the porters love them, is they would perform a private concert in the closed capsule of the railroad car in the middle of the night. And I don't know about you, Mark, but if I could go back to any moment in history, being at that concert and having the Ellington Band perform just for me would be pretty darn special.
There's so much special that is covered throughout this book. The good news is all three of them lived long lives. That would not necessarily be expected by the treatment they received and their own exhausting work, their travels. I mean, they didn't get to the peaks that they got to without incredibly hard work, and the fact that they were all geniuses. And I don't know how hard it was for whites in those days to admit their geniuses. Back when I was in college, I did some study about it, ended up dealing with civil rights. And one book in particular mentioned that before the 1940s, even enlightened whites still thought of blacks as somehow inferior. They might have brilliant blacks, but that if you put all whites against blacks, that the top black would not match the top white. And fortunately, I think we live in an age where most people, at least in the U.S., I think most of them recognize that that is completely prejudicial and false, and there's no basis for that. We had three geniuses here that exceeded any whites in the same field. And there were some nose-to-nose competitions, right? The side-by-side they'd play sometimes, right?
They did, and you were exactly right. So I think what happened in that era is that these men were quiet insurrectionists. They basically showed through the magnificence of their melodies that that was the way to open America's ears and souls to their genius and to the notion that they deserved equal rights. And if I could tell you for a second what I think was going on behind closed doors across the country was that white men who would never have thought about allowing a black to cross their threshold wooed their sweethearts with the gravel-throated music of Louis Armstrong and with the Ellington Band. That white women, who if they saw a black man coming towards them down the sidewalk, would have walked to the other side of the street. In the privacy of their own living rooms, they tossed off their high heels and they danced to the toe-tapping melodies of the Basie Orchestra. For once, race faded away and America listened rapt.
Back to you, though, Larry. You wrote about the Pullman Porters, and people can find that on your website, LarryTye.com. Tye is T-Y-E, folks. LarryTye.com. You wrote about them, and when you're writing about Ellington Armstrong and Basie here, there's just a couple points where the connection between Jews and these jazz masters comes in. Your Jewish background yourself enriches you, maybe motivates you. I mean, once you know how it is to be treated as second class by the people around you without any basis, it sometimes helps you be motivated to lift up other people. So talk about the connection of Jews to these wonderful people.
So I'd love to talk about two things that you just raised. One is, as you say, the connection between Jews and these musicians. And all three maestros, Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, had Jewish managers. All three had Jewish bandmates. All three had Jewish friends. And this was part of the 20th century's Black Jewish Alliance. Two groups of outsiders, two groups that loved telling stories, bonded together in a way that was nowhere richer than the bond in the world of jazz. And Louis Armstrong, when he was growing up in the streets of New Orleans, in a neighborhood so tough it was known as the Battlefield, was informally adopted by a Jewish family named Karnofsky, which hired him to toot a horn on their rag wagon. And they went through the streets of New Orleans selling rags and realized if you had somebody blowing a nice melody, that it would attract attention to the wagon and to what they were selling. And they adopted him. They brought him home in the evenings, many evenings, to eat great meals at their house, to listen to Lily Karnofsky sing Jewish melodies. And Louis Armstrong was so touched by that experience that for the rest of his life, he wore around his neck a Star of David. And he titled his third memoir, To the Jewish Family in New Orleans. And so that's the story of Blacks and Jews as told through these jazz men. But you rightfully want to know, what does the author have in mind when he picks a topic like this for a book? And to me, any book that I've written, whether it was about Bobby Kennedy and Joe McCarthy or about the Pullman Porters and the baseball player Satchel Paige, you're using the narrow lens of one person, or in this case, three people's lives, to tell a bigger story. And the bigger story in this case was that social change in America never happens in a straight line. Very recently, we celebrated the 70th anniversary of maybe the most momentous Supreme Court decision in history, which was Brown versus Board of Education, integrating America's schools. And we didn't get there by a series of one court decision following another. We got there by America being slowly prepared for the notion of integration by our integrating our baseball stadiums, by our integrating our bandstands, and by our integrating all kinds of cultural aspects of our lives. And it was as great a figure as Martin Luther King in a speech that got almost no attention when he delivered it in the early 1960s, said that if not for jazzmen like these three, we would not have had Brown versus Board.
Yeah, and Brown versus Board of Education, I think, was 1954, which is the year I was born. I'm not saying that cause effect there, but I am saying that the progress that we started to get, Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, didn't accumulate right away. It was still another 15, 20 years before integration of schools really started. It happened in some places, but most places not.
As a fellow 1954 guy, I think that you're exactly right. None of the decisions happened instantaneously. They happened through a slow buildup. None of the implementation of the decisions happened slowly. And if I could just give you one example about how long it sometimes took and how painful it was. In 1957, one of the most controversial school integration cases was put into play in a place called Little Rock, Arkansas. And that was when Central High School, the all-white Central High School, was ordered to be integrated by the courts. And a governor of Arkansas back then, a racist governor named Orville Faubus, said essentially, over my dead body, will black kids come into Central High? And in that era, people, whites and blacks, were afraid to speak up and say, this is just wrong, governor, you've got to integrate the schools. Well, one guy who did speak up was a guy named Louis Armstrong, who said, he called the governor of Arkansas a word that began with M and ended with R, which I won't say over your airwaves, but got translated in a family-friendly newspaper to an uneducated plowboy. And he was essentially saying, you're wrong. He also called out our war hero president, Dwight Eisenhower, and he said, President, you've done nothing to protect these kids. You are gutless. And I don't think it was accidental that shortly after Louis Armstrong said that, and he took a lot of heat for saying this, it ended up becoming news all around the world. Shortly after he said that, President Eisenhower sent in federal troops to protect those kids. And people might argue with me about cause and effect, but I'm convinced that it was more than anything else, it was Louis Armstrong calling out the president that helped push the president to take that step.
Yeah. And again, you're talking already the 1950s when some of these things are going ahead into the 60s. By that point, all three of these musicians have been playing since the 20s, the 30s. They're well known. Even in the teens, some of them had some significant following already. But nationwide in the 20s and the 30s, they're getting their word out. So there's generations now that have grown up with their music, loving their music. And when you hear some words out of their mouth that say, we better start catching up in terms of this Jim Crow and everything else.
That is absolutely true. And by the time that we were just talking about, by the 54 with Brown versus Board and 57 with Little Rock, it was said that the two most recognizable symbols of American culture around the world were Mickey Mouse and Louis Armstrong. And I think that was true. And that's why when he did something like speaking out and calling out the president on this issue, it resonated.
And folks, the thing is that the book, The Jazzman, it's a few hundred pages of wonderful stories. You really get the depth of personality and variety. All three of these people, though, are myth makers. They've got stories of their origin. You know, it's not only Superman's origin story that you can read from Larry Tye. You can read about it for Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, how they got to be who they are. So
we take 1 second and talk about just what you just said.
Sure.
Duke Ellington, when he was a young boy in Washington, D.C., growing up in a middle-class household, a whole lot more affluence around than in Louis Armstrong's battlefield neighborhood of New Orleans, when he would walk down the steps in the morning, he would tell his young nephews at the bottom of the steps to bow to him. He would tell his nieces to curtsy, and he would tell everybody, including his parents, applaud, applaud. Someday I'm going to be known as the great Duke Ellington. And he told all kinds of great stories on where his nickname came from, but the one you should believe is that he crowned himself Duke, and he lived up to that aristocratic title, and so did Count Basie. Basie used to tell people, this person or that person was the first one to call me Count. Well, in fact, Count Basie, or Bill Basie as he was known then, printed up business cards. He decided that if Ellington could be a duke, if the great King Oliver could be a king, that he sure as heck could be Count Basie.
Yes. The complexity of the stories of these three men, I think it wasn't until after Kennedy, JFK, died that we started hearing he was having affairs in the White House. Martin Luther King Jr., hearing about his infidelities. It wasn't till after, I think it was after his death, that we actually started hearing some of those complexities, which these are very hardworking, dedicated, godly men who also had, call them, flaws. How do you end up thinking about these three jazzmen?
So I think they were men of deep faith. They were men who believed in God, men who prayed before meals, men who read the Bible, and if Duke Ellington is to be believed, he read it cover to cover three times. But they were also men who managed to violate enough of the Ten Commandments to, in my mind, show that they were flesh and blood and they were real people like us. And the commandment that they probably violated most often was the question of fidelity. Louis Armstrong married four women, one at a time, thankfully, but he married four different women. And even with his last and by far longest lasting wife, Lucille, he was still unfaithful. And she knew that. And she ended up generally with a new mink coat every time he was caught in an infidelity. Count Basie was married twice and was unfaithful enough to his wife that she, at a couple points, threatened to leave him, and at least once did. And Duke Ellington stayed married to the same woman his entire life, but they only lived as husband and wife for a few years. And he had more mistresses than you could count. And the reason he stayed married was it gave him the perfect excuse with each mistress. He would say, geez, I'd love to marry you, but I'm already married and you don't want me to go through an expensive divorce. So all of them, they justified it by saying, geez, we're hardworking. We're out on the road for 300 days a year. How do you expect us to stay faithful? Their wives knew that that was an excuse, but they accepted it because it was part of who these guys were.
And when you say that they were out on the road a lot, it's hard to understand how much they were out on the road. The intensive travel and the around the clock, and you can't sleep here, so you have to go back here to sleep, and maybe you can sleep while you're traveling. It's incredible the amount of work that all three of these men went through, and not just them, but their side men as well.
True. And if I could tell you just two quick stories. With Count Basie, one night he was playing at a theater in Philadelphia, not conventional Jim Crow territory, not legally segregated. He got 10 standing ovations that night. And yet when he left the theater, a white guy tossed him his car keys and said, go get me my car. Assumed a black at that theater meant that he had to be the guy who was valeting cars. Duke Ellington, one night, was trying to find a place to stay in a segregated town in Virginia. And finally, his manager, in despair, went to a white hotel and said, this is the great Duke Ellington. You've got to put him up for the night. And the hotel manager said, we will do that, but you have to pay an extra fee for the pillowcases and the sheets. And the manager said, what do you mean, an extra fee? And the hotel manager said, because, of course, we will have to burn the pillowcases and the sheets after a black man uses them.
It's so stunning to realize how commonly accepted that was. I have to speak personally here. My father grew up in small town Wisconsin. My dad was a really nice guy, in many ways a very upstanding, a moral person, and his racism was deep. It's just so hard to understand that people can have both those things. Be really good, thoughtful, generous people, and have a blindness towards some prejudice that they have. Certainly all three of these men encountered loads of it.
They did, but all three of these men, after they encountered it, it wasn't just that they quietly suffered these indignities. They pushed back in ways that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Jackie Robinson all realized that these were three of their most important allies out there in helping knock down Jim Crow laws, but more importantly, in helping transform the attitudes of otherwise great people like your father. And one way to do that was not to tell people, don't be a racist, but was to play music for them that could only have been performed by geniuses. You know, who in the world could have imagined that Louis Armstrong could not only hit high notes that nobody else had hit, but that he was equally good in performing with his voice, which in Chicago, when Armstrong was coming up in Chicago, young kids in the middle of winter used to stick their heads out of their car windows to try to catch cold so they could sound like the great Louis Armstrong, the only way to duplicate his raspy voice.
By the way, Larry, have you been a jazz fan for a long time? Is this part of your background? I didn't grow up with this. You know, you and I both born in 54. It's rock music, right?
It was, but I grew up also loving jazz, but not knowing nearly as much as I should have to write a book like this. And so what I did to compensate was I talked to 250 of the smartest people out there, from jazz greats like Wynton Marsalis and John Batiste, to political figures like Bill Clinton, who's an enormous jazz fan, to historians, to relatives of these three. And one of the things you do as a journalist is you often begin the day not knowing anything about what you're going to have to write about at the end of the day. And it was that same spirit. It is to me more interesting to write about things that I don't know about, but that I want to know about. And I am intrigued by the story of race in America, and telling that story through these three guys was about the most joyful experience that I could imagine.
Even better than Satchel Paige?
So I've written 9 books, and it's always the last book that's my favorite. Satchel Paige, the idea of going out and calling it work to learn more about the greatest baseball pitcher ever to pick up a ball was joy as well, as was the Pullman Porters.
Folks, Larry Tye's website is LarryTye.com, LarryTye.com. Links on northernspiritradio.org, along with all of my guests of the past 19 years now, Larry. I've been doing this, both my Spirit in Action and Song of the Soul program. You always find links to our guests via the site, and I hope you post comments when you get a chance to visit our site. You can also support us. Larry sells books. I do not do that. My entire income for Northern Spirit Radio comes from donations. And I've also chosen specifically not to take money from either government or corporations. So I'm counting on you, the listeners, to support me. You can find all my interviews with Larry Tye, and there have been quite a few of them. Just come to the site and search and find all of the riches, and then go out and get his 9 books. And before we go on, I want to make sure, Larry, What's your next book going to be? I'm sure you're in it already.
Yes, so my next book, which I just signed up for, is called The Forger of Paris, Adolfo Kaminsky and Jewish Resistance to the Holocaust. And it's trying to, again, tell the big story about Jews fighting back everywhere from the death camps to the forests, from the underground to Allied armies, tell it through the narrow story of an extraordinary teenage forger named Adolfo Kaminsky, who was credited when he died a year ago in all of his obituaries with saving 10,000 lives. And this kid was so good at making false documents that he let people go underground or escape across the borders. And he is, to me, a story that tells the bigger story, which is that Jews did not, as we are told, all go like lambs to slaughter.
There were, unfortunately, some that did. We get trained in by society, just as racism gets trained into people. Certainly, acquiescence gets trained into people. And fortunately, there's more wisdom. And sometimes religion and spirituality can be a deep well to draw strength from to live counter to those norms.
You're exactly right. And I want to just say one quick thing, if I can, which is I've written 9 books. Buy only 7 of them or 8 of them and give the rest to Mark, because the idea of somebody who's telling stories as essential as this is why we write books. It's not just to have the long book version of the story told, it's to tell it in the smart and eye-opening way that Mark does with his interviews. And it is incredibly rare for somebody to take neither corporate nor government money. So free up a little of your cash and send it into Mark.
Also, folks, please remember to support the community radio stations across the country, in particular the 35 or so that carry my programs. And I hope that other stations will pick it up as well. Of course, the world is changing, Larry. You know that people, I think, read books less than they used to, much to their detriment. They're also listening to radio stations less because you access the internet and just pick and choose what you want to listen to. And sometimes you're listening to a podcast. My programs goes out as podcast as well as broadcast. What's this changing in terms of how you put out the word with all your wonderful books?
What it means is when I get done writing the book, knowing that it is more difficult to get people to sit down and read a book that might require 30 hours of devotion to the book, I try to tell the story in as many ways as I can. So I am shameless in going out and writing essays for outlets ranging from the New York Times and Wall Street Journal to Billboard magazine to Christianity Today to my favorite one of the 20 for this book was a publication called Drinks and Drug News. And it was talking about these three men's addictions and how the way that they overcame them is encouragement to people who are suffering addictions. There's a way to parse your book so you can almost put it out where every word gets picked up by somebody else. And I think that all you and I can do, Mark, is continue to tell stories the best that we can and hope people tune into them.
Again, the name of the book, The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America by Larry Tye. And again, links on NordenspiritRadio.org. What you were just talking about, Larry, there's these different sections of the book where you're talking about phases or aspects of their work. I mean, you talk about their early lives, certainly, but you also talk about here's how they were in terms of relationships. Here's how they were in terms of what music they could do. Well, here's what they did in terms of which spouses they had. And the managers, you already mentioned that a number of them had, a number of times, they had Jewish managers. But one of the things that was common in that time, and it was necessary because by being blacks performing in certain areas of the country, they were already skirting the law, right? So they had to hang around with the off-color people. Sometimes it was gangsters who they had to depend upon in order to be able to do their work.
So it was, and it was gangsters for another reason. Gangsters back then, we're talking about the era of prohibition when these guys were getting started. And that meant that it was illegal to sell alcohol, which didn't stop people from manufacturing and selling alcohol, but it meant they had to do it at speakeasies and other illegal establishments. And the managers of these establishments were guys like Dutch Schultz, the gangster. And Dutch Schultz and Al Capone and people of his ilk realized that they had to do something to draw people to their speakeasies. And what better thing to do than these extraordinary jazz musicians? So there was an unwritten rule. We will keep you safe and we will give you enough to live well on if you come and bring people in so we can sell them illegal booze. It was something that was endemic to the world of jazz. It was a sign of the difficulty of getting this new music accepted, but it also helped to launch it. And by the time Prohibition was over, we were in the middle and deep into this wonderful time in American history known as the Jazz Age.
The way that these new forms of music get connected with illicit behavior, illicit, sometimes illegal in other cases, we certainly associate it with jazz, you know, speakeasies, all that kind of thing. But certainly rock music had its drug things. When people talk about rap music or other newer forms, don't they associate it with this dangerous underclass?
You do. And there was a wonderful article in a major national journal called Who Put the Sin in Syncopation? That could be argued in a similar title for articles at the beginning of the rock age when everybody was worried that this is encouraging juvenile delinquency and drug use. And during the rap era, it is that young people are always looking for new and edgy and experimental kinds of music, and that drug use and delinquency happen everywhere, but it's easiest to point and say it's rock and roll's fault or it's these jazz guys' fault.
I also want to talk, Larry, about some of the difficult aspects of this. Again, none of us is the best thing that we've ever done. None of us is the worst thing we've ever done. We're always a mixture. Some people got a lot of bad going on. Some got a lot of good going on. In all of these cases, with Duke, Satchmo, and Count, people could focus in on the bad things they did and think negatively of them. When they're listening to their music, they're not thinking about any of that. They're just thinking about, wow, this is wonderful music. But some of the bad things that they did included drugs and gambling, and they all didn't have the same addictions.
Correct. Louis Armstrong was addicted to marijuana, or as he would say, he just loved marijuana. He would begin nearly every day of his adult life by spending 30 minutes in the bathroom rolling up a very big joint. He would end the day by spending time in his dressing room rolling up another big joint. And yet, it wasn't just that he was spending these 300 days on the road in an exhausting schedule, but he was taking so much grief in terms of the racist slurs that he had to deal with and the affronts that I think he needed the marijuana to just relax and cool down at the beginning and the end of the day. Count Basie was addicted to the horses. He'd show up in a new town, and before he would go off to practice with his band, he would put on his yachting cap, flag a cab, and end up at the nearest racetrack, betting and generally losing at the ponies. And this was an addiction that almost cost him his marriage. He at one point hawked his wife's fur coat, or tried to hawk it, to pay off his gambling debts. And Duke Ellington had a different kind of addiction. His addiction, in addition to his addiction to attractive women, his addiction was to superstitions. He was allergic to the color green and to the color brown because they somehow suggested the ground and dirt and being buried. And he thought that that was bad luck and he would end up in an early grave if he wore things that were green or brown. He was afraid of flying. He had all kinds of fears, some of which were semi-rational and some of which were irrational. And over time, he learned to deal with his superstitions. Each of them had crucibles, but each of them, in the end, gave us two legacies that were brilliant. The musical legacy that all the listeners to your shows know about, and the legacy in helping transform America to grant equal rights to blacks and to help knock down its segregation laws, which are something they almost never get credit for, but deserve it.
Louis Armstrong is a really interesting case. He came under a lot of criticism from blacks for being too much of a caricature of black people at a certain point, big, happy, smiley, goofy kind of person. And so they thought, you know, you're toadying to the whites. And so he got criticism from that. A number of those people who came down heavy on him, I think they turned around within 10 years or something and saw him differently. But I don't think people take into account what a difficult road it was for all three of them. If you're too uppity, you may not only be suppressed in terms of your music, but you can end up dead.
So that's absolutely true. And they were all three headliners at Las Vegas casinos, casinos that they could enter only through the kitchen door. They all three had to put up with stuff that would have just deterred most everybody else from pushing back at all. And yet they all three persevered in a way that let them make an enormous difference, but also took a toll on their health and on their emotional well-being. And I think that that is why that they all bonded with one another, because it wasn't just that they were born within 5 years of one another and that they all lasted an extraordinary half century at the tops of their fields, but they all knew what it was like to have to put up with this kind of grief. And America, the same America that was a racist society in those days, sent these three guys around the world, the State Department did, as unofficial ambassadors, because we knew in that superheated era of the Cold War that the most effective argument that Moscow could make against America when it was trying to win over unaligned nations was to say that we were racist. And when Armstrong, Ellington, and Basie got behind the Iron Curtain or went to these unaligned nations, they all were uber patriots. They all said, yes, we've got problems back home, but yes, we are fixing them. And that was something that should have made America proud and did make the State Department proud.
That's a lesson that many of us could learn from. A lot of us won't, because sometimes it's very empowering just to see those people are bad people, we're the good people, and not to see the complexity of humanity. And these three people, all of them took in incredible amounts of money eventually, really big piles of money, and they also threw it away, sometimes by gambling and sometimes by buying something for a mistress and sometimes in very generous ways, paying their sidemen very generously.
Sometimes by being cheated by their managers. All three of them hated dealing with the business side of things, and all of them didn't keep tabs the way they ought to have on who was managing their money at any given time, and all three of them probably got taken advantage of. But as Louis Armstrong said, as long as I have enough to do what I want to do, my managers can take the rest. And it was just, they made and spent, as you suggest, piles of money over the years.
And sometimes they had to have a lot of money to spend on their spouses, considering that they've got some contrition to show.
Absolutely, that too. And that they've got some mistresses to support.
And sometimes children and parents of their mistresses or mistresses of their wives. They were a whole support economy within the Black community.
Were, and especially Duke Ellington, who maintained his band 365 days a year, whether they got 200 appearances or 365, he was paying salaries all the time. And they were really generous. They took a lot from their sidemen, but they also gave a lot.
The relationship to the sidemen, how they work together, I tend to think of Count Basie as being the most cooperative in terms of raising up the group together. His face was there and his hand bouncing up and down and playing the keys. He certainly had enough attention coming to him. But what I got from the book, Larry, was that in fact, Louis Armstrong was the one who was most invested in keep the limelight on me. Am I overstating that?
You're not. So Armstrong definitely wanted the limelight on him, and he wanted his sidemen to be good, but not be too good. Duke Ellington, who was composing and orchestrating and leading the band as well as playing the piano, had a big ego, but it was also about the band. And Count Basie had the, relatively speaking, smallest ego of the three, and he was therefore known as the best band leader of the three and maybe in all the world of jazz. And with him, it was really about bringing out the most in his sidemen. And he was also the shyest and the most secretive and didn't want his story to be front and center.
It's interesting to think of someone being shy when they're constantly inviting people to stare at them. I've known introverts who are great actors and so on, but when they step off the stage, it's like, don't look at me. But on stage, it's all about them. Let's talk a little bit more about how deeply religious or glancingly religious, what their particular faiths were for all three of them. You already mentioned that, you know, Duke Ellington would do Bible reading every day.
He did. So they were religious in a way that was reflected partly by what they did in a ritualistic sense, but it was also reflected by the fact that they all borrowed music from their youth in the churches. It was gospel music. It was the music of the sanctified churches. And that was a critical part of what they did. And Duke Ellington, especially in his later years, performed what he called sacred concerts at churches around the world. And he felt that his music was all about spirituality and that his music belonged in the church. And I think he rightfully understood that rather than discouraging people from going to church, that if the church embraced his music, that it would draw people to the church. And I just, a couple nights ago, did a program at what is known as the Jazz Church, a Lutheran church in the middle of New York called St. Peter's. And before my talk, there was a Jazz Vespers, which they have every Sunday night there. And it is the recognition that music is about spirituality in more than just the gospel music sense, and that jazz music, if listened to in the right way and appreciated in the right way, will encourage people to think about their own spirituality, about their own godliness, and about ethical issues which lie at the core of church teachings.
And for the others, what religious groups did each of them get nurtured by in their youth?
Louis Armstrong, it was a combination of the sanctified churches and a bit of Catholic church. With Armstrong in Ellington, it was different denominations because in Ellington's case, his mother was, I think, a Methodist and his father a Presbyterian, or I may have the affiliations wrong, but it was two different churches and he would one Sunday go to one and the other go to the other. And Count Basie, it was, I believe it was Methodist church in his case, but they all came from families where church going as well as God-fearing were a part of their norm. And while they couldn't go to church as much as they might have wanted to, given their performing schedule as adults, they all brought the church into everything they did.
And folks, if you come to northernspiritradio.org, one of the interviews you might want to check out is my interview with Ken Grossinger. He wrote a book called Artworks, and he talks about art in many different forms, whether it's drawing or music and other forms of art, and how that helps power the world forward. So I'm not sure most people think of jazz as being a political change medium, but it certainly was.
Hugely was, and I think it continues to be.
I mentioned early on, Larry, that all three of these great artists, they told their stories. Sometimes people like Count Basie are a little bit shyer about telling their story, but all of them have kind of a mythology that goes with them. And sometimes it was a changing mythology. Here's what it was. I was an altar boy. I mean, I don't think they said that, but I was an altar boy. Here I was a gangster. Here I was. And they move all around the place. Oh, I'm dedicated. I was always faithful to this person. But in reality, early on in the book, I said, wow, I can't trust a word that's said about them because everybody's got a story that contradicts these other stories. How did you wrap your head around it? It just seems impossible.
I tried to distinguish what they said from what actually happened when there was a distinction to be made. And as you suggest, these guys were all about being storytellers with their music, and they were storytellers when they were using words and talking about themselves. And a lot of the time, they embellished or they left out things that might not make them look so good. But what I discovered in the end was, in the most important story to me, which was the story of their contribution to equal rights and to human rights, they underplayed this story. They all said, we let our music speak for itself, when they didn't. They went out and through their actions, as well as their music, showed that they weren't going to tolerate the continued existence of racism if there was anything they could do about it, and there were amazing things they could and did do about it.
You talked about the sacred concerts that he did later on. I don't have the sense that the culture as a whole latched onto them near as much as a lot of their popular music. From my point of view, it's so important in our work to do the work that answers our soul's call, even if it's not what other people necessarily want to hear.
I totally agree. And these guys were all about, whether they were writing sacred concerts or their general music, were all about spirituality, were all about touching our souls. And they touched the soul of America in a way that I think changed that soul of America for the better.
When I got your book, I felt like, because I'm short on jazz, actually I'm short on classical too. Folk music is kind of my thing, right? And popular music of the 60s and 70s when I grew up was certainly what's powerful to me. What about you? So when I got your book, I said, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to find some of their music and just familiarize myself with it, feel it a little bit in my bones as I'm reading your book. What for you became songs that really grip you or that carry you or that make a difference for you?
While I loved jazz music, I was not a student of jazz music, and I had to go out and listen. I had to tell my Alexa device to play the songs of Ellington Armstrong and Basie repeatedly. I was grabbed by some of their more toe-tapping tunes, in Count Basie's case, 1 o'clock jump, and music that swung like that. I was enraptured by Ellington favorites, and there was no more favorite Ellington tune than Take the A-Train. And what intrigued me about it was the music, but also the story behind it. The fact that that music was written by a young protege named Billy Strayhorn, who decided he was going to impress Duke Ellington by taking the directions on how to get to Ellington's place in Harlem and making them into a song that involved taking the A-Train. And I was intrigued by Louis Armstrong, who started out with the most spiritual and moving and virtuosic kind of music and ended up with pop culture kinds of music. And the songs that he was probably best known to in later generations were songs like Hello Dolly and It's a Wonderful World. And only Louis Armstrong could take mediocre pop tunes like that and make them into virtuosic kind of music. And it just he sold 3 million copies of Hello Dolly, and Louis Armstrong at age 63 knocked the Beatles off of the number one slot in the Billboard charts with his song Hello Dolly.
That's so wonderful to think about. Yeah, you capture so many wonderful stories in here. It really is a study in depth, as opposed to the glancing, here's the top few notes, although those top notes matter. And when they get older and they can't hit those notes, it's like, do I want to be on stage anymore? And they all had to fall from their godlike status in some ways.
They did, but they never compromised. The idea that they did without compromising their artistic sense, stay on top for 50 years is just brilliant. They did it by partly sticking with the core of what mattered to them. They also learned from the people who were trying to push them aside, whether it was the beboppers or the rock and rollers. And to this day, everybody from Bob Dylan to Paul McCartney think of these three jazz guys as the shoulders that they stood on.
Well, it's an inspirational book. Again, folks, the book is The Jazzmen: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. And you can always count on Larry Tye to bring the stories of those people who transform our country to the world. And just keep in mind, he's got another book coming up that he's going to tell you about how someone over during the Holocaust was actually transforming the world silently. And I guess it's another kind of artwork to be able to do forgeries.
It is a kind of artwork. It's a little bit of art, a little bit of science, and it is always a huge pleasure to be on with you and get to be asked smart questions like this about something that I'm passionate about.
Again, Larry's website, you can find it via northernspiritradio.org, but it's not too hard, larrytye.com. Get all 9 of his books and join us again next week for Spirit in Action.
The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find Deep Roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.